Our noon hour look at WILL News. Our next report this afternoon at 4:30. Illinois Public Media News is always online at will.illinois.edu. Follow our Twitter handle at Will Public Media.
Support for today's broadcast comes from Community Blood Services of Illinois. Donated blood saves the lives of the injured and critically ill. There are no substitutes for donated blood, and donation takes only 45 minutes. Blood donation, it's about life. More information is on the web at bloodservices.org.
Let's take a look next at weather. Very windy day today across the Midwest. And a wind advisory is in effect until 6 p.m. Central Time this evening for the WILL Severe Weather Coverage Area. Decatur Airport, Willard Airport, and Champaign and Bloomington Airport had wind gusts this morning over 50 miles per hour. The Indiana Toll Road is temporarily banning some trucks from using the highway because of high winds. Indiana Toll Road officials have banned all triple trailers and long double trailers, excluding steel haulers, from using the highway today. Also worth noting, gale warnings have been posted for Lake Michigan through tonight. The gusty south winds will help to keep temperatures on the mild side across most of the region today. A cold front stretching from western Wisconsin through northwestern Iowa and back into the central plains will continue to track toward the southeast today. This front will likely bring showers and thunderstorms to the Midwest tonight and into tomorrow. High temperatures today will range from the upper 30s across northwestern Wisconsin to the low 70s across the Boot Heel of Missouri and into western Kentucky. Overnight low temperatures will range from near 20 degrees across northern portions of Wisconsin and Iowa to the upper 50s across southeastern Missouri. The forecast for east central Illinois, again, that wind advisory in effect until 6 p.m. this evening. This afternoon, partly sunny, very windy and warm. Expect a high around 70. The wind out of the south at 30 to 40 miles per hour with gusts to 55. Tonight, there's a chance for evening showers and thunderstorms. Showers and thunderstorms are likely after midnight, the low 52. It will continue to be windy with a wind from the south at 20 to 25 miles per hour with gusts to 35 tonight. Tomorrow, morning showers and thunderstorms are likely. Then we'll have a chance of afternoon showers and thunderstorms. It will be cooler with a high in the low 50s. The temperature will hold steady or fall slowly during the afternoon. The wind out of the northwest around 15 miles per hour with gusts to 25 miles per hour. Tomorrow night, partly cloudy and colder with a low in the low 30s. The wind from the northwest at 5 to 10 miles per hour. Friday, sunny. Look for a high in the upper 40s with a wind from the north at 10 to 15 miles per hour. Friday night and Saturday, mostly clear. The low Friday night will be in the low 30s. The high Saturday in the low 50s. Across Illinois and Indiana at noon Central Time, temperatures were in the 60s and there was a mix of sun and cloud. At Rockford, Chicago, Bloomington, Carbondale, and Terre Haute, it was 65 degrees, also 65 degrees at Willard Airport. Mattoon reported 63 degrees, 64 at South Bend in Lafayette, and Indianapolis, it was 67 degrees at the top of the hour. Again, Willard Airport reported 65 degrees at noon, a cloudy sky. The dew point 45, the relative humidity 48%, the wind out of the south at 36 miles per hour with gusts to 51, the barometric pressure 30.03 and falling in at 1241, 64 degrees in Urbana on the campus of the University of Illinois. This story is about weeds and weed killers. It's also about plants with superpowers. Unless you grow cotton, corn, or soybeans for a living, it's hard to appreciate just how amazing and wonderful it seemed 15 years ago when Roundup-tolerant crops hit the market. But some weeds are becoming Roundup-resistant, and there's a big argument about what farmers should do next. Here's NPR's Dan Charles.
The combination of Roundup and so-called Roundup Ready crops was so amazing when it came on the market 15 years ago, it made grown men giddy. Roundup killed everything except for your cotton, soybeans, or corn. Those crops were genetically engineered to withstand the herbicide. It changed American agriculture. It made controlling weeds so simple, farmers went out and rented more land. Farms got bigger. And then the magic started to wear off. At different places in different parts of the country, farmers realized that some weeds were not dying. In Georgia, it was a plant called Palmer amaranth, or pigweed.
It started just north of us here, three or four counties up.
Randy Bryant grows cotton in Irwin County, Georgia. At first, he thought it was just somebody else's problem.
And then all of a sudden, it was all over South Georgia. We had it everywhere.
This strain of Palmer amaranth has a genetic mutation that makes it resistant to glyphosate, the weed-killing chemical in Roundup. Pigweed can grow 3 inches a day. A single plant can release close to 1 million seeds. This is a bully. Let it sprout beside cotton seedlings and the poor cotton won't stand a chance. Farmers in Georgia, like Van Grantham, are hiring people to go into cotton fields and pull the pigweed by hand.
I got a brother-in-law told me this year he spent $120 an acre on hand labor.
That's about four times what weed control used to cost. Farmers are looking for solutions, and the man they turn to is Stanley Culpepper. He's a weed scientist at the University of Georgia and the state's expert on cotton weeds. This time of year, he spends his days driving from county to county, delivering talks to cotton farmers.
We all agree that there can be no glyphosate-resistant Palmer amaranth up at planting, right? We've crossed that bridge. We know it has to be no Palmer at planting, or you probably won't pick your crop. If you do pick your crop, you won't be economically sustainable.
Culpepper grew up in North Carolina and comes from a long line of farmers. He talks to these cotton growers like a football coach giving his players some tough love. The days of easy weed killing are over, he tells them. You can't be lazy anymore.
You go out and look at the field, you say, oh, I got me a few more days. And what happens when you say, I'm going to wait a few days, those pigweeds come up and they're 4 or 5 inches when you get there and you can't kill them.
You'll have to spray a whole bunch of different chemicals to overwhelm the enemy, Culpepper says. Some will kill your cotton if you aren't careful. Now here, he says, here's something completely different. He puts up a new slide, a picture of a field that's covered with a layer of rye lying flat on the ground. This residue works as well as any weed killer, he says. Pigweed just hates it. So we can grow this cover crop of rye, and we leave some narrow gaps in it. That's where we plant our rows of cotton. I'm still working out a few kinks in this technique, he says, but in just a few years, I think this is something you should try.
If we can figure this out, this program is the most sustainable program we as cotton people could do, no question, bar none, for resistance management and for Palmer control.
So here's Stanley Culpepper's recipe for surviving in a world of Roundup-resistant weeds. Do lots of different things. Some of them involve chemicals, some don't. Some will mean more work. But there are other recipes out there, and the one that may be really tempting for farmers is more genetically engineered crops. At this same meeting, there are representatives from three big cotton seed companies, Dow, Monsanto, and Bayer. Those companies are selling, or plan to sell very soon, crops that have been engineered to tolerate other herbicides that will kill pigweed. So farmers may be able to spray those herbicides, old ones called 2,4-D and dicamba, right over their crops. Some environmentalists are angry about these new products. The Natural Resources Defense Council, for instance, says 2,4-D is dangerous and ought to be banned. And David Mortensen, a weed ecologist at Penn State, predicts that weeds will evolve resistance to these herbicides, too. It's a kind of treadmill, he says, where farmers constantly need new weed killers.
When one herbicide fails, then we add a second herbicide and you churn it for a while and then add a third herbicide to that package. And I am convinced that that is not a sustainable path forward.
Stanley Culpepper, meanwhile, stands somewhere in the middle of this argument.
Let's be clear. I want all the new technology that's economically and environmentally friendly for our growers that we can get.
But we can't misuse the technologies, he says. We can't overuse just one or two of them. He thinks his farmers have learned that lesson. And what happened with Roundup will not happen again. Dan Charles, NPR News.
The makers of soft drinks are under pressure to stop using an additive they've used for a long time to give colas their color. Consumer advocates have raised concerns about the safety of that additive. Now manufacturers have come up with a solution they hope will put the issue to rest. NPR's Allison Aubrey reports.
Around the corner from Studio 3A, here in the NPR newsroom, a cubby of vending machines draws traffic 24 hours a day.
I need a drink, so there we go.
Senior editor Maria Godoy pops open a can of Coke Zero. Coke is popular here, and the way this bubbly drink gets its brown color is from a type of caramel coloring. Consumer advocate Michael Jacobson of the Center for Science and the Public Interest says a chemical in the coloring is shown to cause cancer in rodents. He says it's nothing like the caramel we'd make in our own kitchen.
It starts with sugar that's treated with ammonia under high temperatures, and that's what leads to the carcinogens. And we don't think that this should be used in the food supply.
Now, the Food and Drug Administration says we'd have to drink something like 1,000 cans of soda a day to reach the doses that appear to cause cancer in rodents. But nonetheless, last year, the state of California placed the chemical, known as 4-MI, that's found in the coloring, on a list of cancer-causing agents and told soda makers that if they didn't get most of it out of their products, they'd be required to print a cancer warning message on every can, a decision the soda industry says was ridiculous.
Caramel color is now, has always been safe and harmless.
That's Ted Nixon. He is CEO of the world's largest manufacturer of caramel coloring. Coca-Cola is one of his clients. When California regulators made it clear that they saw the 4-MI in caramel as a problem, he says his scientists went back to the drawing board.
We did have to change these various inputs of temperature, pressure, and the various ingredients that we're using in order to change this one attribute.
So starting a few months ago in California, with no fanfare, Coca-Cola and other soda makers made the switch to this newly modified caramel coloring. Coke plans to use it nationally going forward, though they say the 4-MI in their product never posed a health or safety risk. Allison Aubrey, NPR News.
Illinois public media stations celebrate 90 years of public service broadcasting. To kick off a year of memories and celebrations, NPR congressional correspondent Andrea Seabrook will visit the WILL studios. Join Andrea Seabrook and the WILL news team for a wine and cheese reception on Wednesday, April 11. Tickets are $25 a person. Reservations can be made by calling 217-333-7300.
Here is the Writer's Almanac for Wednesday. It's the 7th of March, 2012. 1923, on this day, Robert Frost's poem Stopping by Woods on a Snowy Evening was published, the poem that he called his best bid for remembrance. Frost originally claimed that he wrote it all at once, but an early draft of the poem shows that it was reworked several times. He said the poem was about a December night when he drove a wagon to town with some produce from his farm to sell so he could buy Christmas gifts for his family. He couldn't sell a single thing. Evening came. It started to snow, and he had to head back home. He was almost home when he was overwhelmed by a feeling of shame, and the horse stopped, and Frost sat in the wagon, and he wept like a baby, he said. Eventually, the horse jingled its bells, and Frost pulled himself together, and he headed back home to his family. It's the birthday of the novelist Bret Easton Ellis, born Los Angeles, 1964, published his first novel, Less Than Zero, when he was 21, undergrad at Bennington. The graphic story of wealthy teenagers in Los Angeles and their world of drugs and sex. Ellis probably most famous for his novel American Psycho, about Patrick Bateman, the investment banker serial killer. His most recent book is Imperial Bedrooms. It's the birthday of the novelist Robert Harris, born Nottingham, England, 1957. He was a journalist, vacationing in Italy, lying on the beach, listening to German tourists talking all around him, when he suddenly imagined that he was living in the victorious German Empire. He got up, he went swimming in the ocean, and by the time he came back to shore, he had an outline in his mind for a novel about what the world would be like if the Nazis had won World War II. That novel was Fatherland. It was an international bestseller in 1991. Went on to write many other books, including Enigma, about British codebreakers, World War II, Archangel, and his most recent, The Fear Index. Robert Harris, who said, "It is perfectly legitimate to write novels which are essentially prose poems, but in the end, I think, a novel is like a car. And if you buy a car and grow flowers in it, you're forgetting that the car is designed to take you somewhere else." And it's the birthday of Rick Bass, born Fort Worth, Texas, 1958, a geologist who read Jim Harrison's novella Legends of the Fall, and it decided him on becoming a writer. 1987, he and his wife moved to northwestern Montana, to the Yaak Valley in the Kootenai National Forest.